Hello, welcome to The Lore You Know, a show where we chat with some amazing human beings who are storytellers, collectors, and folklorists as we discuss the history of, inspiration behind, and the importance of recording regional tales. My name is Aaron. I am the producer and showrunner for The Lore You Know, temporarily hosting today, folks. Temporarily, don't panic. This is a one-time thing. Filling in for Heather Mosier, who is taking a much-deserved break from her normal hosting duties. Everyone knows how hard Heather works, or maybe you don't, but she is on hiatus this week. Joining me for a very, very special episode, this is the 40th episode of The Lore You Know, folks, is Heather Mosier, host of The Lore You Know.
Yay!
Welcome to the show!
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here on the other side.
Of course. So in case you're not familiar with how this goes, no, I'm just kidding. Folks, we thought it would be great if for our 40th episode, our audience got to know Heather a little bit better. Because if you've listened to any other episodes of this show, you have heard Heather ask hundreds and hundreds of questions of dozens of very interesting guests over the years, but you haven't had the chance to hear Heather's answers to those questions. So that's what we're doing today. Are you excited?
Oh, I'm excited.
Me too. This feels so strange, but in a good way. So let's start with the basics. What brought you into the world of the weird, as it were?
So the world of the weird would have to be probably my earliest introduction would be Unsolved Mysteries, right? The pinnacle of television.
Classic.
Yeah. Robert Stack's voice was really something. And Unsolved Mysteries got me interested in all of this and gave me that morbid curiosity of things. It gave me my first all-nighter, if you will. After watching the Yeti episode, I was terrified of they showed a picture of a Yeti hand or a supposed Yeti hand, and all night long I just imagined seeing that claw like grab my door handle and shut my door. So I stayed awake all night.
How old were and, you?
Feel like that had to have been kindergarten.
Oh, wow.
So however old that would be. And, at one point, I don't have it memorized now, but whenever I was little, I would memorize the phone number. So at the end, when they'd say, if you have any tips or anything like that, call this number. And I would just sit there and recite the number with them.
Did you ever call the number?
No. Oh, okay. No, I never did that. I wasn't like a prank caller or anything like that when I was younger. Maybe now that I'm older, if I could still remember the number, I'd just give it a call just to see what it is now. You know, I've done that with some of my research. I found like old hotlines where you were to report like Bigfoot sightings or something like that. And I've called the number just to see if it's still active. And they're not. They're just random things now. Nothing exciting. But anyway, who knows?
Yeah, you could still. I'm Robert Stack. Maybe you can solve a mystery. No, that's so cool because I've heard a lot of your guests say Unsolved Mysteries, you know, over the years when you ask similar questions. So that's cool. I feel like that's a common denominator for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's something. I think it's a generational thing for sure.
Absolutely. I agree. So getting a little more recent then, you know, of course, Heather Mosier is the famous person behind many, many things going on at Small Town Monsters. But how did you end up working with Seth in the first place?
Well, I was persistent is how that happened. I started working with Seth. Well, I was aware of Small Town Monsters back when Minerva Monster first came out, which was the first STM film. I was aware of that because I grew up in a little town called Carrollton, Ohio, and our rival was Minerva in school and so on. So, and now I live in Minerva. But anyway, the point is it was very close. So whenever somebody starts making a documentary about a monster in the nearby town, you kind of hear about it. And it's not as if Bigfoot wasn't something that people have always talked about in this area, because we have. But also, the Bigfoot was starting to come back into popular culture, it seems like, because I definitely remember it being talked about in times around like Unsolved Mysteries or whatever, and then things kind of lulling, at least in my awareness, which could just be me being a kid and doing my own thing or whatever. But then eventually it comes back into popular culture and people start talking about it more. And anyway, Minerva Monster came out. STM got on my radar from that point. And I kind of followed along. And when Mothman of Point Pleasant came out, there was a segment that Seth had put in the film where it talks about a book by, oh my goodness, I just forgot his name. But he's a folklorist anyway. In the book, I can see the book perfectly. It's orange with a little haunted house on the cover. When he got into the folklore of it, I thought that there was something really special about that. Not just talking about the story of the monster in history, but talking about folklore. That got my attention. And so I tracked Seth down on Facebook and messaged him and said, "Hey, I really enjoy what you're doing here. Thanks for putting that extra time into it." And we started talking on and off from that point. And a couple years later, I was doing my own research on cursed objects. And the cursed object, like one famous one, cursed objects, I should say, are rocks that you can take from the Bellwitch Cave. People go to the Bellwitch Cave, they take rocks. They end up having bad fortune. They send the rocks back and say, "Please return these. My life's falling apart." And I was studying cursed objects around the country, but that was one of the ones that had got my attention, of course. And Seth had announced that they were going to be doing, at some point in the future, a Bellwitch movie. And since I'd already looked into that that topic, I had messaged him again. And I'm like, "Hey, if you ever need anybody to help with research, I would gladly do that. It's something that I miss doing. I did it quite a lot in my graduate work. And it's just really where my heart is." And he's like, "Yeah, I'll keep that in mind. You know, that would definitely be helpful." And so I just kept throwing that out there every once in a while, like, "Hey, if you need anybody." And one day when they got closer to like actually had it set in stone that they were going to do it, because a lot of times Seth will have ideas of things that he wants to do 4 or 5 years in the future. But until we know, sometimes it's not until a year out or so that we know for sure. So when it got to that point where he's like, "Okay, we're doing this movie," then he contacted me and he's like, "Hey, I would love to have you on to help with research. Before we get to the Bellwitch though, could you help me with Momo?" And I was like, "Yeah, no problem. I'll help you with Momo." And I had no idea who Momo was. I didn't know anything about Momo. But, you know, what do? You start Googling. I start looking up newspaper articles until I understood exactly what had happened. And then I helped him from there. So I helped with Momo first. And then Mothman Legacy. And then Bellwitch came into the picture. And then since then, it seems like the role is ever... And this is with everybody involved in STM. I think we can all attest to this. Your role is ever evolving.
That's
constantly
true.
New stuff is getting added to your plate and different things. And so I went from, like with Momo, it was as simple as sending Seth a bunch of names of people that may potentially be witnesses. I had not contacted them. It was just a list of names and numbers and addresses, to what I do now, which is leagues beyond that. So that's how it all started with STM. I just kept hounding Seth is really what all came down to. I know he hates that, but.
Well, I mean, I'm sure he's grateful that you did, you know.
Yeah.
I know just from.
Hopefully.
I'm pretty sure he is. I know just from being on a couple of shoots with you that, you know, we talked about this on a live stream recently that you weren't on. I think it was for On the Trail of UFOs. I don't remember. But any STM production nowadays, there's all the stuff going on camera. Then there's all the technical stuff you don't see, which is the camera crew and Seth directing things and the audio stuff. And then there's Heather behind all of that, somehow holding everything together and maintaining some semblance of a schedule, which I was going to say is also ever evolving and constantly changing. But somehow it happens. Somehow you're able to do that. So here's an interesting question. If someone were to ask you, what is your job title or a quick job description, what would you say?
So I always go with researcher and producer because I still feel like that kind of encompasses pretty much everything. Okay, so here's the thing. It's not as if I've been a producer prior to working with Small Town Monsters. So to me, when I say producer, then that kind of encompasses everything that I'm doing. But I have no idea, realistically, if you were to talk to another producer that's worked for someone else, I don't know what their job description is. I just know what mine is. So I do research and I contact witnesses and I try to get a schedule together for whenever we're actually there, like boots on the ground for the filming, and hope that everything adheres to that schedule, but also build the schedule so that it is fluid enough that if something falls through or someone doesn't show up, because that happens, that the whole thing doesn't collapse. Because that's my biggest fear, is that all of a sudden, you know, one domino falls and then the rest of it is done and we're just stranded in LBL with nothing to do, or, you know, whatever, like that cannot happen. So that's my biggest thing, is to make sure that we have a schedule that everything is still going to function, even if one piece falls away, and that not everything is so intricately hinged that if one thing goes, then the whole day is ruined, because we can't afford to do that. So, I don't know. I would just say, I always say producer and researcher, and just hope that people understand what that means, I guess.
They can come up with their own ideas, but it speaks to the core of the thing.
right, exactly.
Well, and so you do a ton of work on the film side of things. But, you know, as anyone who's been listening to this show knows, there's a lot more going on in the Small Town Monsters world than just our film releases. So how did this show come about? How did The Lore You Know end up being a thing? Because that has been for a long time the flagship show of the Small Town Monsters Broadcasting Network. And I'm speaking from the perspective of a listener, not just as the person that helps produce it now, but.
Right. You're like, no. So originally what happened was we were kind of, in one of these creative modes. There were a handful of us at the STM office and we were just coming up with ideas for potential shows. And The Lore You Know, the idea of the name came from, of course, The More You Know that would come across the screen back whenever us millennials were younger, The More You Know after school type special. And originally I thought The Lore You Know, it would be fun if it were like an after-school special where we talk about different aspects of folklore or urban legends or whatever. And then at the end of it, make it kind of campy. We go through a specific urban legend and then at the end, the more you know, or the lore you know kind of thing. But ultimately what happened was we came up with, like, that wasn't going to work based on what we could do at the time. But the name stuck. And then Seth said, what about doing an interview show? And who would you want to sit down and interview if you could just do a one-on-one kind of thing? And we had to put together a list of names of people that I would like to interview. Some of them, like Linda Godfrey, was on that list, but she was already not feeling well by the time that this had come around. So that never came to fruition. But just put together a list of names and then started contacting people to say, would you be willing to sit down and just talk with me about stories? And that's how that kind of came about. At the time, it was the new show because we had Monsteropolis and there was Sass What going on at the time. We had more podcasts going. I don't know. It's been a lot of fun. That's how it started, though, was this idea of this like after school special of The Lore You Know. Things would have been better if you would have had Lore You Know, you wouldn't have fallen for that urban legend or something like that. So
I love that idea. It's so cool that it evolved from, like a parody almost the way you're describing it into this full on interview show that is now so educational and so enlightening. Like, you know, it's almost a course study in mythology anytime you listen to one of these.
Yeah, awesome. I'm glad that it comes across that way, for sure.
That's how I feel about it.
Yay!
Well, that kind of takes me to the next question. You're a professor.
Yeah.
We don't hear about this very often. And I feel that people should be aware of the fact that Heather is a bona fide professor. Not like some of us in the niche like to say, I'm a professor of paranormal studies. No, Heather is a bona fide college professor. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience working in academia, what that's like, how that translates into what you do now?
Yeah, so I'm an adjunct. I do not have my PhD as far as that goes. I have my master's. So I'm a professor, but I feel like in some ways, you know, that imposter syndrome gets in there every once in a while. Like, you don't have that PhD, so you're not quite a bona fide professor, but I am. I understand that.
I'm a college dropout. Thank you. You are a professor. Please continue.
So I am in the modern and classical language studies department at Kent State University. I teach in the classical languages. So each semester, it depends on what they need, but I'm either teaching a class called the Roman Achievement or the Greek Achievement, which talks about basically what it would have been like to be a person living in Greek or Roman times. We don't really get into a ton of, you know, like the emperors, the kings and whatnot. It's more like, this is what your day-to-day life would be like if you were just a regular person living in that time frame. So that's what I teach. Everything seems to be pretty separate. Like, it's not like I sit down and send out messages or have conversations about, hey, if you guys have heard of Small Town Monsters, or do you like Bigfoot, or, you know, it's a completely separate thing. But classical studies is where my heart had been since I started college. I declared classical studies as my major pretty early on, and then went on for my master's degree in Latin literature. And really, what that did was it taught me how to research and research properly. Research became a second nature type thing, as much as we had to do, because when you're in classical studies, it's not as if you can sit and listen to, like, you can't turn on the TV like political science and listen to the politicians talk, you know, that they're not here anymore. So you've got to do a lot of reading. You have to be aware of when you're reading, like, who wrote that particular book and why they may have written it, because of course there's always political intrigue behind the scenes. So like, my undergraduate thesis was about Julius Caesar's memory fluctuating over time. You go from Julius Caesar immediately after his death being deified to then throughout the reign over various emperors throughout time. Sometimes he is absolutely horrible and they don't want to talk about him. He's something really evil. And then other times he is godlike. Sometimes he's part of the family and that I'm legitimate because I was related to Julius Caesar kind of thing. But it all has to do with what was going on politically at the time. So having that awareness when you're reading something, everything seems to have an angle to it. So knowing that when you're reading, that's something that's come in helpful. Being aware of the importance of being able to verify something that's said. And I can't tell you, like, the number of times that you might find an article online and you go to verify it by just find a second or third source that verifies this. And you see that everybody's just copied and pasted the same stinking article. And you don't even know where it originated by the time it's all said and done, because everything's just like that. What kind of weight does that hold if it's only talked about in one source? You know, just weighing the pros and cons of that. So that all has helped, I think, just sparking the interest in going into old, of course, articles weren't relevant back in Greek and Roman times, but going into old books, and then now It's not so much that there are a ton of old books, not that I can't look at mythological things and find correspondences with what we do today, but going back into old newspaper archives and sifting through that stuff, like, I love doing that. And it's just something that was instilled in me from very early on when I started my college career to, you know, you got to love research or there's no point in doing all of this.
Hmm. Well, you're able to access a lot of materials that with your professor's credentials that a lot of people can't necessarily get access to. I've noticed that just in projects you and I have worked on together. You'll send me this article from the 1920s that's totally on the nose that I never would have found. And like, I just think that's a testament to how good at this stuff you are. Wasn't a question.
Oh, thanks.
Something I wanted to say.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. Yeah, it's another thing that when you bring that up, that a lot of that is because I have access to, so there's a website called JSTOR, which is a database of a bunch of journals and archives, things like that. And sometimes you can go in there and search and find some stuff every once in a while. It's not super great all the time for what we do, but every once in a while when you can find something that fits, it is a gem, really.
Yes.
It's exhausting all options is what happens whenever we start into research here at STM. We're exhausting all the options.
Everything. Yeah, I can attest to that. Well, that's a fun segue because there is an article from JSTOR that is used as a source citation in a book that you are presently editing as editor-in-chief of Small Town Monsters Publishing, which is another aspect of your varied and diverse and ever diversifying role. So let's talk about STM Publishing a little bit because you do so much work behind the scenes there. But even I don't know what exactly you do all the time.
What I do.
Yeah. Aside from dealing with dozens and dozens of messages from me every day in your email inbox about all these things I'm trying to do. So what does that look like for you? The publishing side of things?
So the publishing side of STM is fairly new still. And it is something that also is ever evolving. When it first started, like the first book that we put out was a children's book and there wasn't a lot of, editing that really needed to be done. The book was already, it was already illustrated. It was already a short story. I mean, I think there might've been one edit that we needed. I don't know if it was a comma or a word, I don't remember, but there was really nothing that needed to be done before it was ready to be published. To this year, we're putting out three books. And it went from somebody coming to us with a book to saying, "Hey, Aaron, what do you think about Dogman? And what about in the LBL kind of thing?" You know, like, and you're like, yeah, definitely. I'm on it. And then you jump in completely. And so we go from just the idea to the outline and, you know, you're changing the outline, adding more chapters, combining chapters. And so from my side of things, as you're working through it, I'm just waiting for you to get to the point where I can like just edit a chapter, chapter by chapter, which has been helpful. It's a lot less intimidating than getting a full manuscript and saying, okay, here you go, just edit all of this right now. Being able to go chapter by chapter, I think has been pretty helpful, actually. I've enjoyed that. And with you specifically, from the beginning, because it's something that I've watched you create, like as you come up with ideas and stuff, sometimes it's been cool to not only edit, but add things to it. Like add questions. Hey, can you expand upon this? Can you add upon this? Or send you an article that might work just to add a little more depth to a particular argument or a facet that maybe wasn't necessarily needed, but just adds a little more to it. Like that stuff has really been fun. So right now it's me editing. I've got the other two books, the manuscripts are done. So I've gone through and I've edited both of those one time through. I've edited yours at least one time through right now. and then we're going through chapter by chapter. So you and I have this system of edited, ready for edit, ready for second edit kind of thing.
Yeah.
Going through that, heavy edits, things like that. Then the next step is going to be putting it into a program and making it look like a book. So, because right, like you and I are working through Google Docs. Sometimes I get to work through Google Docs. Sometimes it's all Word documents. I'm learning a program called InDesign to make things look snazzier as a book. Because up to this point, all of our books, I have been using Microsoft Word, which apparently is like the most difficult thing to do from what I've been told. It's literally the only thing that I knew. But I've been told by other people who create like zines and books that to not have InDesign, I was wasting essentially hours and hours and hours of time just trying to get the formatting to work for Microsoft Word, because it's not meant to be a book publishing source.
That sounds so strange, but please continue. Sorry. Don't write books in Word.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm learning a new program and that's taking some time. But once I learn it, then I'll know it, right? That's what I'm telling myself as I go through it. And I'm getting frustrated trying to learn new commands and new new sets and things. But yeah, it's just, it's a lot of editing and the formatting. See, this goes into, like, you said editor-in-chief. If somebody were to ask me what I do for Small Town Monsters Publishing, I'd be like, well, I edit things. But it's not just edit, because I do have to format the book. I mean, when it's all, when the book is formatted and ready to go, then it gets sent to Zach and Zach will format like the cover and make sure that it looks right whenever we go to put it in the publishing website to get it printed into book form. But prior to that, like the manuscript itself, I have to make sure that everything is aligned, and every once in a while you'll get it ready and you think it's perfect and you go to hit preview and you see that one chapter is on, like, the chapter heading is on the wrong page. And then you're like, oh shoot. So then you have to go and fix that. And know that that's now just a special edition copy.
hint for anyone listening.
Yeah.
There may be a limited edition misprint of an STM book out there somewhere. I don't know.
Right. There might be, but it's super limited because once it was caught, boy, it was fixed.
Yeah. So if you find it, hang on to it. Mm-hmm. It's only a few.
Hang on to it and search out the author and have the author sign it, and bam. I don't know who that could be or where that that one right there.
Sorry.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking for me when I saw that, because of all the time that I'd put into it, and then to find that, I'm like, oh, what a mistake. But you handled it well, so that was
I was sincerely excited. I'm sorry that that is an upsetting thing for you, because I was like, there's gonna be a super limited misprint of my book. I was so happy. I'm still happy about it. So for weird book people like me, and maybe I'm sure you can relate to this, you know, like slightly different editions, things like that, are very exciting. So
there's a book on my shelf right now. I won't name whose book it is, because I contacted the author when I found the misprint. It was in the very beginning, and you could tell that it was like the editor, you know this because you and I work in Google Docs, so you can see the comments in real time. But as an editor, sometimes I will put in notes to myself to look at something later. So a friend's book had come out, and I went and bought their book, and I'm looking through the intro stuff because I was curious about how the front matter looked, and I can see in parentheses where the editor had put, why isn't this link working? Ugh, or something like that. And they clearly didn't notice it. And I, I saw that and I immediately was like, oh good. Someone else has made mistakes like me. This makes me feel normal. And I contacted the author and I said, I just want you to know that I found a misprint and I think it is the best thing ever. It has helped me immensely, you know, as an editor, makes me feel not as much of a failure. And the author was like, dang it, he was mad that it was in there, that he had missed it and they had also missed it. But I'm like, no, please don't be that upset. It's great. You know, I'm sure that who looks at the front matter anyway? I don't even know how many people would have caught it because nobody's looking at like copyright 2023. Because that's where all of that was in the minutiae that nobody really pays attention to, unless you're learning how to be an editor.
Yeah.
But I have that book and I know that he got it fixed. So new editions don't have it anymore. So in my mind, I'm like, that book, I need to get him to sign that someday. So I have that misprint signed and ready to go.
Yeah. You understand. So it's the same. It's a similar thing. Yeah. It's that exactly. little, that uniqueness. Well, speaking of books, we have to go over some favorites. I know the listeners want to know what Heather's favorite things are. So,
oh my goodness,
do you have? And it's probably difficult to name just one. So, what are some of your favorite? Let's say three, maybe top three nonfiction books.
Nonfiction.
Yeah.
Okay, because if you had said fiction, I would have been like, that'd have been real easy.
Well, that's next. You can do that first if you want.
Okay, great. All right, good. Well, I got that one ready to go. So nonfiction books. I honestly don't know if I have probably anything by Ruth Ann Music when she goes over the West Virginia folklore. So there's two books of hers, and I enjoy, well, there's more than two books of hers, but there's Coffin Hollow and A Telltale Lilac Bush. I like both of those. Witches, Ghosts, and Signs by Patrick Gaynor. Those are also another folklore book. I really like Backwoods Witchcraft by Jake Richards. I'm looking at my shelf now to see what all I've got over there.
Sorry to put you on the spot. I knew this was going to be.
No, it's fine. It's totally fine. But really anything that's going to be, that has little folklore stories in them are going to be something that I enjoy. But as a very specific book that's nonfiction, I don't know. It'd be something like Ruth Ann Music's books I have to have with me at all times. So I would say The Telltale Lilac Bush and Coffin Hollow would be two of my top three. And the third one would probably be rotating depending on what I'm researching at the time. Cause a lot of times that's also an ever evolving thing. So what book is helpful becomes my favorite at the time. Like the most helpful one becomes my favorite book at the time.
Makes sense.
And that's always changing.
Makes sense. Do you have a ballpark as to how many books are in your like paranormal folklore nonfiction library?
Oh boy.
You asked me this when you had me on, so I've been planning this for a long time.
So I've gotta have a couple hundred, I would think. Because I've tried to catalog my books before, like all books that I have, and I've gotten close to 1,000 before I've stopped, as far as the number of books that I have. And of course that all changes. So a lot of that's classical books because that was my love for a long time. So a lot of them are those, and now it's folklore and monster books. So, I would say I probably have a couple hundred of those. And they used to be organized really well, but the more stuff that STM gets into, the more they get mixed, like Dogman's Next to Bigfoot or UFOs of various types are mixed together with the Bellwitch books. Like all my Bellwitch books used to be together, but now they're not. They're mixed up with things too. So someday I'll put them back together in order where it'll make some sort of sense.
Just that ever evolving bookshelf. Like it's, you get it done and then you go to the bookstore and then everything changes.
Oh, right. And then especially if you get to go to a used bookstore and you find something that hasn't been in print for a while, and you're like, this is gold right here.
Right.
It's not even like, I'll go to Books a Million or something. And that's always fun to go in and look around, but it's not as exciting as going to some of these local bookstores or used bookstores and finding the smaller publishing company prints and stuff.
Yeah, that's where the surprises are. Like,
yeah, well, that's also where you get like a lot of the local legends and stuff. You're not going to find those at Books a Million necessarily. They have like a little section of local stuff, but that's still not necessarily local authors. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I am with you on that one, 100%. So what about fiction? Do you have a top three in the fictitious literary world?
Yeah, because it's a trilogy. It's called The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers, and Return of the King.
Ooh, the classics, the all-time classics.
Yeah, those would be my favorite books of all time. The Hobbit's pretty good too, obviously. But if we're going with three, you got to go with the trilogy. So
are you, how do you feel about the movies?
I think they're fantastic. I am not going to hate on the movies, and I will not hate on the Hobbit movies either, despite what some people think is cool to do, to hate on the Hobbit movies. My thoughts are, if we can get Peter Jackson to direct anything that's Lord of the Rings related, let him do as much as he wants to do, because he's only going to do justice to it in my mind. And who knows if we're ever going to get this particular backstory in any other format at any other time. So if he wants to add more stuff to it, that's great. Yeah. I will consume as much Tolkien as they're willing to put out there. So
have you watched the new Amazon series? I haven't. I have.
I did. I watched it and I enjoyed it, actually. I think they did a great job with it. I'm thrilled with how they put stuff together and the quality of it. They clearly used every penny that they spent, that they said it was worth. I think it was pretty obvious that they utilized all of that. Yeah, I think they did a good job with it.
Awesome. How about after Lord of the Rings? Is there a runner up, or maybe not a close?
Yeah, probably nothing really close. nothing really close to that. So there's a series called Incarnations of Immortality. And it's by Piers Anthony. And I like that series in general. Like On a Pale Horse was one of the first book of the series. And the idea is that something like death or war are people, but they rotate through. So every once in a while, someone that dies, they're going to be reassigned as death. And then they have to take on that role for a while until it's someone else's turn to take over that. And they've got war, death, Mother Earth, the Fates. And I'm trying to think if there were other ones that I can't remember right now. I know there are, but that whole series I found extremely fascinating, a different way to look at potentially the afterlife, and to look at some of these mythological figures, to think that maybe they're not consistently the same creature, the same person with the same thought structure, that maybe that morphs over time. I found that very intriguing. So
fascinating. Yeah. Piers Anthony was a very prolific writer, so that's a cool deep cut. So here's another essential question. This might be the one that everyone's waiting for. What is your favorite cryptid?
My favorite cryptid. That's tough. So I go by favorite cryptid by one that I would definitely not want to meet, I think. Would be how I describe my favorite one. So it's tough to beat Goatman, because I would never want to meet a Goatman. Because goats freak me out. Like, regular goats freak me out. It doesn't have to be a half goat, half man. Well, I don't like goats.
Yeah, they're not right.
They are. Their eyes are weird, right? It's their eyes that really mess me up.
I was attacked by a goat. Yeah, I'm there with you.
Yeah. Yeah. So Goatman's one of my favorites. The idea of a Wendigo is also one of my favorites, because that's absolutely terrifying. So I guess those ones would be, I guess I would categorize them as my favorite, but it's hard to not like something like Rougarou, but that's also because of how much I was involved in the creation of that too, that movie, that Rue Gru became one of my favorites. And also because the Cajuns say it really awesome, like, which I can't, I can't pronounce it like they do, but Rue Gru's up there as well.
It's a good one. Skinwalker Hollow the Rue Gru is one of my favorite SDM films. And that was true. I think I had just met you around the time it came out. So I was going to say that was true before I ever met you guys, but it was definitely true before I started working with you in any capacity. You killed it on that movie. It is such a good one.
Thank you.
Yes. If you haven't seen that one, folks, go check it out. It is an essential.
That's right. Heck yeah.
Well, that kind of takes us back to, you know, the film production and the shoot aspect of things. What is the craziest thing, or if there's more than one, what are some of the craziest things you've experienced on an STM shoot? Because you've traveled all over the place with these folks now at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. One of the craziest things. Well, there's lots of fun memories and stuff. There's a few frustrating times, like, I specifically remember when we were out in Colorado, we had an issue with someone that we were hoping to interview, and they got kind of extra mean with me. And that one was like off-putting as far as that goes. But we've had crazy things where we've thought we had lost the DJI at one point. That happened in Texas.
Oh, yes. I remember that.
Yeah. And that's one of those ones that you kind of feel helpless until it gets found. Let's see. The first STM trip that I was on was for Lake Michigan Mothman, on the trail of Lake Michigan Mothman. And I remember it was the first night we got to the Airbnb, and they started to put out the equipment, and we had forgotten some of the cameras. Like, we didn't have all of the cameras that we needed. And I remember thinking, oh crap, we just drove up to like Chicago area or whatever, and we're 5 hours away from home or whatever, and we don't have everything we need, but we still made it work. So things like that occur every once in a while. We forget stuff. We might run out of batteries, or things aren't charged like we thought that they were, which isn't like super crazy. I'm trying to think of, there wasn't a, so this was on a trip to the Smoky Mountain Bigfoot Conference. There was one time, this isn't crazy, this is just a funny story, where like I wear glasses, right? Because I can't see far away. Up close, I'm great. I don't need my glasses for that, but far away, I can't see anything. And I remember Courtney starts yelling that there's a mother bear outside of our Airbnb. There's a mom bear outside with cubs. So I go running out to the porch, and I'm looking, and I don't have my glasses on because it's early morning. It's pouring down rain, and you see this mother bear and you see these cubs, and I get my phone out and I start filming. And as she's going through the rain, all like three or four of her cubs start following her, but one of them stays behind. It's like stuck. And she just keeps going through the rain without it. And I'm yelling like, you left your baby. You left your baby. She doesn't care. She just keeps going. And in my head, I'm thinking, I'm going to have to go down there and see if I can help this cub somehow. I don't know how.
Because why would you not do that?
Because why would you not? It's stranded in the pouring rain. And I'm like, it's stuck. You left the baby. And all of a sudden, and I'm filming it. Like, I'd filmed this baby by itself. I'm zoomed in and everything. And Courtney all of a sudden says, that's just a log. What are you doing? That's not like they had walked by it. And my brain said that was an extra cub there that was just staying behind. But I didn't see it because I didn't have my glasses on. So I'm zoomed in. I still have the video on my phone of me zooming in on this log going, oh, you left the poor baby behind. No, it was just another instance where Heather couldn't see because she didn't have her glasses on. There have been countless times where the guys have felt it necessary to convince the girls that there's somebody in the house that we're staying in. This started in Colorado, and it has been just a consistent thing ever since, that if we're out and it's dark when we're coming back and we leave some of the lights on in the house, they'll be like, oh, did you see somebody just walk by the kitchen window? And and the one in Colorado, it was Shannon and Courtney and I that were there. And the guys told us as we were coming up to our ranch house, they swore that they saw somebody there. And so we go in and we start looking in every room. We flip on all the lights. The girls do. The guys don't care. They're just sitting there. Eventually, they start laughing at us. And then it comes out that they had made the whole thing up. They just wanted to make us paranoid. So now that's a thing that we're like, did you see somebody? As we're pulling in at night, I think I saw somebody in the kitchen. We're like, shut up. You know, that's a legitimate fear. It's a fear that I've had since I was young. I mean, it starts back with like the Villisca axe murder house. Like somebody sneaks in and just waits. And so like, that's a fear I've had since I was young. And they just prey upon that every single trip.
Statistically, the amount of traveling that Small Town Monsters does, eventually there is going to be somebody in the house. Eventually, if they keep this up, and nobody's going to believe them. So.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No one's going to believe them. And then it's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. And it, yep. Yep, and it won't be my fault.
It will not. No. That's why we're putting it on record now. It will not be Heather's fault.
That's right.
Got a list of names for you. So we're coming up near the end of the show. We're not there yet, but we're approaching what is my favorite segment of The Lore You Know, and that is the segment in which Heather asks the guest to tell her a story. Now, obviously, Heather is the guest today. So, Heather.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a story?
I will. And to be completely honest, about halfway through our interview, I was like, oh, shoot, I'm going to have to tell a story at some point.
Yep.
And I am not.
Well, I didn't send you any notes either. So that's, you know.
No, that's fine. It's not as if I don't know the format of the show. It's just that, yeah. Well, is there a particular type of story that you're curious about? I can tell a story about the first like haunted doll that I got.
Oh yes, start with please. That. Dolls terrify me. I won't have them in my home. So yes, please.
I won't have them in my home.
Don't like them.
So okay, so it was the second time that I went to Adams, Tennessee. The first time that I had taken my children, though. And I had spent the day at the Bellwitch Cave in the little gift shop that they have, because that's where all these letters of warning. Sorry, I'm totally stuffed up. There's all these letters of warning are for people who have taken rocks or whatnot, and they send it back to the cave. So they add these letters to the wall of the gift shop, which adds to the folklore, right? It adds to the allure. And you're not allowed to take pictures within the gift shop. So I asked if I could stand there and literally like copy the letters by hand. And they said yes. So I'd been there for hours copying these letters.
Wow.
I'd already gone down to the cave once, but then when I got the kids there, they came into the gift shop. We got tickets to go to the cave again. Went with them into the cave. Nothing really happens while we're in there. But on the way back, my youngest daughter, who at the time would have been 4, takes off from the rest of us. And she runs up to the gift shop ahead of us. Like the way that it wasn't concerning that she ran away from us. There's really nowhere for her to go. It's not like this is a very busy area. She could just run through a field up to the gift shop. So she runs up to the gift shop. By the time I get up there, she's sitting on this bench and she's holding this doll, which in the gift shop, obviously they have gifts, but one of the things that they have on the back wall are these dozens of porcelain dolls that they have painted up to look various stages of grotesque or zombie-like.
Like you
do. You can buy those dolls. Yeah, like you do. You can buy those dolls as a souvenir. There's a little tag on it that says Historic Bellwitch Cave. Anyway, So my youngest is sitting on the bench and she's holding one of these dolls. This doll's in a Christmas outfit. And I walk in and she's all excited. And the girl behind the counter, who I'd been talking to all day, so we were already on a first name basis by this point, she starts apologizing to me. And she's like, "I'm sorry, Heather. I tried to convince her to take a different one." And I'm like, "What do you mean? Take a different one." And she said, "Well, she wanted that one. She was insistent on that. But I tried to tell her that if she wanted one that was in a, like a Christmas outfit, we've got this one over here." And she starts pointing to other dolls. She's like, "But she wanted that one." And I said, "Well, what's the big deal? Which doll she got?" And she said, "Well, last week that doll was on the top shelf, which would have been, I don't know, 6 feet or more off the ground." She's like, "That doll was on the top shelf. And, everybody, we had a bunch of people in here. It was pretty full. And that doll like flew off the top shelf several feet forward and fell down to the ground. It didn't break, even though it's porcelain and it was hardwood floor. But it like threw itself off the shelf. It didn't just fall down. It went several feet off and fell to the ground." She said, "So we had put that doll on a lower shelf because we thought if it's going to start acting up, we don't want it to break before we sell it," kind of thing. So they put it on a lower shelf, which a week later, when my 4-year-old walks in, it's at her eye level, right? So she grabs the doll, says she wants the doll. So I sit down and I ask her, "Well, why did you choose that one?" And she said, "Well, because she's nice and nobody else is really going to want her because she just doesn't look that pretty. So aww. I just don't think it's fair." And I'm like, "Oh, that's really sweet." And I said, "We'll take her." And they just looked at me like, "Are you sure you want the doll that threw itself off the shelf?" And I'm like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." So we got her. I have her. Hold on.
Oh, God.
So this is Sasha.
Gracious. Oh, my.
Yeah. Her name is Sasha. that my daughter named her that.
To our audio listeners, you can view the horrifying spectacle before me by signing up for the squad and watching the video version of this interview.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. She's got a little, you know, Christmas outfit on. She's got the gift. But Sasha, anyway, is what my daughter said her name was. And
it's a beautiful doll. I just say horrifying because I'm scared of dolls, but it's beautiful. It really is.
Yeah, she's so pretty. You wouldn't tell her otherwise.
No.
I would not. And anyway, so we brought Sasha home and my daughter held her the whole way home and would talk to her. And every once in a while, once we brought her home, she would want to play with her. Which she's porcelain, so you can't really play hard with her or anything, but she'd set her up and they'd watch cartoons together or whatnot. And where Sasha is, there used to be this candle. It was an automatic, like, or not automatic, but just a battery operated candle. And it didn't have a timer or anything on it. It just had an on or off switch, but it would turn on when Sasha was nearby. It would turn on, and if you turn it off, it would end up turning back on. So Sasha really liked that candle, is what we said. At the time that this had happened, I was writing for the Weird Writer blog for Shannon LeGros' Into the Fray radio page. And I started to write a story about Sasha, about haunted dolls in general, and started to write about Sasha. And the littlest one comes in the room and she sees Sasha's name on my screen. And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm writing about Sasha." And she said, "Sasha doesn't like that. You should stop." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not going to write anything bad about her." She's like, "Sasha doesn't want people afraid of her. You should stop."
Oh, goodness. Don't like that.
Yeah. I was like, okay. So that's like a disclaimer at the bottom of that article, is that my child just walked in the room and said this. But anyway, so that's the story of Sasha, our haunted doll. And she came from the Bellwitch Cave. And then it was a year or so later that the guys went down to Adams to film The Mark of the Bellwitch. And because I'd already been down there and made friends with everyone down there, I had messaged ahead of time to Kara, who's one of the guides at the cave. And I said, "Hey, if Chris is still selling some of those dolls, can you go and pick out one and send it home with the guys? So I can have another doll." And so she went and she picked out this one. So here's another one.
Oh, my goodness. Hello. Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And I told her, because she's like, well, which one, you know, what kind of doll do you want? And I said, well, I want you to go in and just look at them. And then the one that like speaks to you is the one that you're going to send home. So she went in and she picked this doll. And she said that we should name it Blair after the Blair Witch. So this is Blair. And it was funny. Seth was super thrilled whenever Kara brought this doll to him to bring home. All the guys were super thrilled that they got to bring that home to Ohio.
Yeah. I would imagine. Oh my. I would like to say that on the record that both dolls are beautiful and wonderful and that there's no reason to haunt me. Sorry.
No reason to fear them.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
My ring light just started wobbling while you were telling that story, and I'm trying to figure out how that happened. no cap. But no, that's so cool. I think that's the one place, Heather, where I found our interests diverge, because I am terrified by haunted objects, dolls especially, and you are so good at being fascinated by them.
Yeah, yep. I just want to see what'll happen. Just want to see what'll happen. Lily did say when Blair came home, she said that Sasha and Blair shouldn't be in the same place because Sasha doesn't like Blair. That's what she told me.
Oh my.
Now they're both kind of stationed in the same area today and nothing has happened. So I don't know.
But yet.
Nothing yet.
Oh my. So what is next, Heather? What can we keep an eye out for? I would ask where can we follow you, but it's here as well as, you know, where else?
Yeah. I mean, if you want to, I write every once in a while. So if you want to see some of the stuff that I've written, you can go check out this cool anthology called Dark Village, or you can go and check out The Feminine Macabre. I'm in volumes 1, 3, and 5 there. STM stuff that's coming forward. I mean, there's this really cool book that I'm reading. It's called Hunting Grounds. That'll be out soon.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, I recommend that one for sure. We've got so many things coming out with STM this year. My head is still spinning. It seems like there's always more stuff that we're adding to the roster. So just keep a look on our socials that someone is running flawlessly, by the way, and they'll keep you updated on what's coming and what to look forward to. I'm super excited that we finally have a date for American Werewolves 2.
Yeah.
That one is close to my heart as well. Getting people to talk to us for that was a little tougher than some of our other films. So the more challenging a film is, usually the more I adore it, because I've had to put extra work into it, it seems like. And so American Werewolves 2, which will be out on March 15th, that's one of the ones that's close to my heart too. So look forward to that.
Heck yeah. And at time of broadcast, you still have time to back the 2024 Small Town Monsters Kickstarter campaign. Lots of rewards still available. Get your name in the credits. You can support the next wave of STM films along with all the other cool stuff that's coming up. So definitely check that out.
Absolutely. And get that exclusive stuff. Like, that's the only way you're going to get that hardback of Hunting Grounds.
Yeah. Yeah. Goatman statue, Cursed Waters art print, Cursed Waters Blu-ray DVD also is still on the table with stretch reward. So check that out.
Yep, and a special shirt and zip-up hoodie. All that is only Kickstarter exclusive, so get on it.
People ask, where can I buy that? You can't. Only at the Kickstarter.
Exactly.
Well, Heather, thank you so much. I've been super excited for this conversation for a long time. I know our listeners, your listeners, are going to be really excited to hear it. I think that brings us to the end. Do you have any closing thoughts for us? If not, I'll just cut.
Nope. I don't have any closing thoughts. This was great. A lot of fun. And yeah, it was nice to be on the other side of the, I would say the other side of the microphone, but I'm on the same side of the microphone, so that doesn't really work. But, you know, the other side of the podcast.
Yeah. Role reversal is a fun thing sometimes. It's good to not have to think of questions. I feel that. So, folks, thank you so, so much for listening. Tune in for our next episode where Heather will be back in the hosting chair. I will be back behind the scenes, and we will be joined by another very, very special guest who we're not going to tell you who it is. You'll have to tune in to find out. Thank you for listening, and until next time.
The Lore You Know is presented by the Small Town Monsters Broadcasting Network. You can find out more about this and other network shows, as well as Small Town Monsters films, books, our upcoming Kickstarter campaign, and much more at smalltownmonsters.com. If you enjoyed this show, consider giving it a like, rating, review, or sharing it with a friend. And be sure to tune in next time for another episode of The Lore You Know.